This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Everybody loves the orcas now that they're in danger of disappearing. But it turns out it wasn't always that way. And so we have consulted an orca historian, Jason Colby, who's actually an environmental historian. He tracks the history of the environment at the University of Victoria and has written a book about this. So you're telling me at one point the orcas were feared and vilified?
Absolutely. This was an animal that was considered not just a pest that ate valuable salmon and fur seals, but rumor had it attacked people and it was very common for divers to get out of the water when they were sighted. It was extremely common in Puget Sound and the rest of the Northwest for fishermen to take shots at them. This was really considered a vermin species and a dangerous one at that.
Which is why they were called killer whales, I assume.
Well, kind of. I mean, that root actually comes from a Spanish phrase for whale killers. And so, mm-hmm. but the meaning whales that ate other whales. But the name is so ominous that it really became menacing to people.
So, what changed that?
Well, it really changed right here in the Northwest, and in fact, the most pivotal event took place right on the Seattle waterfront. In the summer of 1965, a local entrepreneur who owned the first real major Seattle aquarium, doesn't exist anymore, entrepreneur named Ted Griffin, bought an orca, a large male orca who had accidentally been caught by Canadian fishermen in northern BC, built a floating pen and brought this whale named Namu all the way south hundreds of miles onto the Seattle waterfront and became the very first whale to be in shows, mm-hmm. choreographed shows eventually with Griffin himself. Griffin became the first human being that we know to swim with a killer whale.
Wow. So this is before
really
SeaWorld?
Transformed.
This was before SeaWorld?
It is. In fact, SeaWorld received their very first killer whale from Griffin after Namu became so famous. And in fact, Namu was written up in National Geographic. Headlines appeared all over the world about this surprisingly friendly killer whale on the waterfront of Seattle. And SeaWorld, which was brand new at the time in San Diego, actually bought another whale that Griffin captured in Puget Sound. And that whale, initially, they wanted to name that whale Namu as well because that name was so famous, and Griffin refused, and so they opted for She Namu, which became Shamu.
Shamu. So, ironically, perhaps, what changed the reputation of killer whales was bringing them into captivity, and then it comes full circle, and that became the wrong thing to do.
It does, and at the time, it's important to remember that people had no idea how many there were. We certainly didn't have any idea that there was this limited population, these three pods, these southern resident orcas that are now endangered. And so the run on live capture of orcas, especially in the late 60s, early 70s, had a really profound impact on the population, along with the other human violence and the depletion of salmon. And so, yes, by bringing them into captivity, studying them alive for the very first time, and having these close encounters, people, went from thinking about them as the fearsome blackfish and the killer whale to this lovable orca that became so iconic for our region.
And now we have only about 70 left. How many were there back in the day?
There's lots of estimates, but generally a pretty good estimate is that in the around the 1850s and 60s before commercial fishing arrived, this population may have numbered as many as 200, 250. But with overfishing, the damming of the great rivers such as the Columbia, as well as rivers in Puget Sound, fishing and development and on the BC side as well as the Washington side. It's really become in many ways an urban lake for them, the Salish Sea, and their search for prey, their main prey, Chinook salmon, has become more and more difficult, especially in recent years.
So what is the importance of orcas now to the Pacific Northwest, besides just, they're amazing animals? They have spawned an industry, haven't they?
They have. I mean, the governor's office in its report notes that, you know, the whale watching industry brings in, you know, some $60 million into Washington state alone, and actually probably more in BC. But I would push it beyond the financial value and talk about what this population, this endangered population of orcas, really means to people in the Northwest. I mean, they've become the icon of our region, surpassing even salmon. And it's hard for us to imagine this place without them. They've become a part of the fabric of our culture, the way we understand our interaction with the marine lands, the marine ecosystem. And I would also say that they've given a tremendous amount to us unknowingly in helping us rethink the way we interact with wildlife. I mean, they really were transformative for us on the Pacific Coast. And so, you know, we need to ask ourselves if we have a moral obligation to them to make sure that they survive.
Well, of course, they feed on salmon. They don't just feed on salmon, though, right? Don't they eat seals?
Well, there are different ecotypes, and the you know, an ecotype that specializes in hunting marine mammals in our area, especially seals and sea lions, is actually doing well and growing. Those are called the transients or big killer whales. Mm-hmm. The endangered population, the southern resident killer whales, who really range from northern California to southern BC, but it spent a lot of time in Puget Sound, they feed almost exclusively on salmon and beyond that, overwhelmingly on Chinook salmon, which are the largest but also the rarest in our waters.
So they're kind of fussy eaters, you're saying?
They're very fussy eaters. They're we could almost call them culturally conservative, and they they're having a difficult time adjusting to how we've changed the ecosystem. You know, previously Chinook salmon, as most Northwesterners know, were famously abundant, you know, in our rivers, and now we have just a fraction of those runs left, and this population of orcas is having a really hard time adjusting to this new ecosystem and the way we've changed it.
Now biologically, could they be taught to adjust? I mean, it'd be great if they take away some of the seals, because I know that the fishermen would appreciate that, but or are they so specialized in the way they've adapted that they can only eat one type of salmon?
This seems to be, I mean, they do feed on other types of salmon kind of selectively when the need presents itself, it seems. But this is the flip side of orcas as extraordinarily efficient social predators, is that, you know, a lot of the characteristics that make them so efficient in targeting particular species, in this case Chinook salmon, make them really reluctant to adapt and to change. And, you know, part of this culture that they have, really, this food culture is an important part of their matrilineal structure. The fact that they have, you know, mothers and grandmothers leading these pods, their knowledge of these Chinook runs probably shapes their migrations and where they look for food. And the frightening thing, I think, for us and probably for them, is that the knowledge that had led them to, you know, quite a bit of success now seems to be leading them down a dead end, potentially, towards starvation.
So explain to me how this works. You said they've developed a culture. So there's a essentially a style of hunting that is especially suited to Chinook salmon?
Yeah, there's ongoing debates among scientists about whether, you know, animals and certainly whales have what we would call culture. But probably the best argument for this is killer whales, is orcas themselves who have what we might call, you know, specialized dialects among their pods that help distinguish particular populations and even within their matrilines particular calls that almost act like ethnic distinctions for them. They also have within these families and matrilines their own particular behaviors that are unique to them, and their migrations that are passed along, not genetically, but from generation to generation, which is really, you know, the definition of culture. And so part of what we stand to lose here is not just this culturally and historically significant population of killer whales, but a rich and unique whale culture that doesn't really have a comparable anywhere else.
There's of course a call now to breach the dams on the Snake River to restore some of those salmon runs, although that is going to take a while for the salmon to reestablish themselves. Would any of that happen in time to save this population of southern resident killer whales?
I think that's a really positive big step. I mean, the governor's plan takes into account lots of possibilities, and there has to be work across the border because, in fact, this population of killer whales relies even more on the Fraser River and in BC than anything in Washington State now. But taking down those dams in the mid to long term could potentially have a big impact on the number of Chinook salmon that are available. Now, it's a hard question because, you know, those dams are symbolic to people in Washington, Eastern Washington. They still, you know, generate power. They still have a role in transportation. So we have to weigh, you know, what is the value of a whale? What is the value of these whales for those questions of, you know, dismantling infrastructure, which people don't generally like to do.
Is it possible to keep them going by basically feeding them fish?
There's no real history of killer whales outside of captivity, excepting hand provided fish by people. The best option in the short term for this is major restrictions on commercial and recreational fishing of Chinook salmon. It wouldn't have to be of all salmon, but of Chinook salmon on both sides of the border. That would be a really important short term fix. The long term, of course, these questions of how do we help these rivers start to heal themselves and naturally regenerate these Chinook salmon runs. And then there's other pieces of the story that the governor's draft report does touch upon, slowing down vessels, the question of, you know, how do we limit potential oil spills and bitumen spills into the area, and how do we reduce the amount of toxins going in? One of the hard realities here is that even as Northwesterners have grown to appreciate this ecosystem and this animal, orcas, more and more, we've also continued to grow explosively. And so our strain on that ecosystem and the pollution that we put into it has continued to grow. And so we do have to ask ourselves what we're willing to give up in order to have something that's become precious to us.
What would be the low-hanging fruit here? What could be cleaned up right away that would make a significant difference? Anything?
I mean, there's when you're talking about hard policy decisions, there's never really a low hanging fruit, you know, and there's never really an easy solution. I mean, I would give you, you know, my three priorities on the Washington side, and then you know what we need to do on the Canadian side. On the Washington side, the restrictions on commercial and recreational fishing on Chinook salmon is probably the most immediate, and the taking down of the snake of the lower snake dams will provide, you know, a real boost in the long term. And then I think that the whale watching companies on both sides of the border need to be willing to say that they're going to leave the southern residents alone and leave them all the space they need. And so if you think about those three things, that you got three stakeholders there, you know, people in Eastern Washington, commercial and recreational fishermen, and whale watching companies who are all willing, hopefully, we're all being asked to give up something in order to save this species. This population. On the Canadian side, you know, the profound issue, the controversial issue is the proposed expansion of the Trans Mountain Pipeline, which is now owned by the Canadian government, is under challenge in federal court in Canada, and that ultimately may pose the most existential threat of all to southern residents.
Why?
Well, they used to be, you know, much more reliant on the Sacramento, the Columbia River, the Skagit and Duwamish in Washington State, as well as the Fraser River in BC, because of the way that the Washington State and California and Oregon rivers have been damaged and remade. They are now overwhelmingly reliant on the food they get in the summer and fall from the Fraser River. And the Trans Mountain Pipeline crosses, you know, the tributaries and the watershed of the Fraser in a way that, you know, challenges those or threatens those Chinook habitats, spawning habitats, even before we get to tidewater and talk about the noise and the potential for bitumen spill that large oil tankers bring.
So you're worried about you're saying the potential of a pipeline leak into those rivers is too dangerous.
Absolutely. I mean, and we're talking about, you know, crossing hundreds of these streams, and so it's not just a question of what happens in the Fraser River estuary. It's and in the tidewater, it's even before we get to there. And so if that goes through, and if, you know, we have any sort of serious spill or damage in the Fraser River, you know, Washington State can do all it could possibly do to save these whales, and it won't save them because of how reliant they are on the Fraser. And so, I mean, my central message in this question is we really need to think in a really a transborder way. The Canadian government and the BC government need to very much be on board with this ambitious project that the Washington State government has undertaken, but all the stakeholders have to be involved. This can't just be Washington State, you know, attempting this triage treatment of this population kind of at the 11th hour here.
But Jason, haven't the pipeline supporters sworn that it will never leak?
They do. And you know, I think that there's always the best of intentions when you're on that side of the debate. I do like to remind everyone that, you know, we were also assured in the 1980s that, you know, pipelines and tankers were secure, and we saw the Exxon Valdez spill in 1989 and Prince William Sound, which, you know, that marine ecosystem has never recovered from that. Yeah. It virtually eliminated, set on the road to extinction, several populations of killer whales there in that part of Alaska. And, you know, ultimately we have to accept the reality that when you do undertake a large infrastructure project like that and a pipeline expansion, you know, spills are inevitable. And the question is the scale and how will we respond. But is this population and is our ecosystem capable of withstanding any more damage is the real question.
Well, at least we can replace the whale watching trips with slick watching trips and still bring in some tourist dollars.
Probably won't be quite as direct.
No, probably not. Jason Colby has written a book. It's called Orca, How We Came to Know and Love the Ocean's Greatest Predator. It's been out for a while now, hasn't it?
Yeah, came out in Orca Awareness Month, which we celebrate both sides of the border here, and I'm really hoping that our kids and our grandkids get to continue to enjoy them.
Jason Colby is an environmental historian at the University of Victoria. Jason, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me on.